This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome and thanks for listening to the Trumpet's weekly review of important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also, newly moved to our Britain office, Warren Reinch.
Good to be here.
So, may I just say that you are making a good choice by listening to this program. The need for real news has never been greater because, at least here in America, the news you're getting from mainstream sources is ridiculous. If you've watched the news in America this week, the most important story is that our nation is now governed by a white supremacist. So we're going to look at some real stories today, beginning with one that shows that people who aren't distracted by all these goofy headlines and are actually looking at what matters recognize just how truly dangerous the times we're living in are. For this, we will go to our man in Britain, Richard.
Yes, just over a week ago, U.S. President Donald Trump officially terminated the nuclear treaty, the interim nuclear forces treaty, or intermediate range nuclear forces treaty with Russia. So it's been gone now for just about a week. This was one of the most significant arms control treaties that limited the nuclear weapons, specifically within Europe, but it had triggered a whole range of discussion about the status of nuclear weapons all around the world in a whole range of different areas. There's been a whole number of interesting headlines talking about this situation with nuclear weapons. Real Clear Defense featured an article from The Strategist that began, "We are in a uniquely dangerous period in the atomic age. Geopolitical tensions have spiked in Europe, in the Middle East, on the subcontinent, and in East Asia. The nuclear arms control architecture is fraying and crumbling, but no negotiations are underway to reduce nuclear stockpiles." So you've got this situation where all around the world, there's lots of different nations looking at improving their nuclear weapons, making them more dangerous, making them maybe more precise, more deadly. Real Clear Defense also featured another article that was talking about some comments made by the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency that was talking about tests that Russia is doing, the way that they've been potentially working on a more precise nuclear weapon. They've been working on something called hydronuclear testing, and Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has talked about developing things like nuclear torpedoes. So all around the world, you see different powers pushing forwards when it comes to nuclear weapons.
Can you just talk specifically, this the Real Clear Defense article that it cited talked quite a bit about Russia and China in particular. Maybe you could just focus on what the developments are in the nuclear programs of those countries.
Sure. So one of Vladimir Putin's big imperatives in the world is to make Russia great again and to make Russia a respected power. And one of the ways that he is doing this is he seems like he's gone back and he's dusted off various different plans from Soviet era Russia that they didn't end up pursuing back then towards nuclear weapons, and has been resurrecting these programs. So just over a year ago, he kind of laid out this whole different array of big nuclear projects that Russia was working on, including that nuclear torpedo I mentioned. He was talking about a nuclear cruise missile, which the Soviets couldn't get to work back then, but you know, technology's moved on a long way since the Soviet era. At the same time, Russia's constantly improving the nuclear weapons that they have. So they've come out with, for example, the Satan II missile, which is the NATO code name for this missile that has multiple nuclear warheads and so can just wipe out vast areas of the map. Those are just some of the projects that we're seeing from Russia. Meanwhile, in China, one of the reasons why America and well, America and Russia have both kind of pulled away from the INF treaty. One of the reasons why America did so is because China is not included. So once America pulled out, there was kind of this diplomatic push to say, well, okay, America, could you be persuaded to stay in this if we got China involved as well? And that seemed like that would America would be fine with that, but China wasn't interested. They don't want any restrictions on their developing this kind of nuclear weapon, and they're kind of pushing full steam ahead in these intermediate range missiles. And these intermediate range missiles are the kind of, these are the ones that people have zeroed in on as being particularly dangerous, because you haven't got very, when you've got a long range missile, an intercontinental missile that's traveling a huge distance, you've got a reasonable degree of time between detection and response. You know, you can make sure this isn't a mistake. You can think about how you want to respond. You could, I don't know, try and get your enemy to stand down or something like, but you've got time. These intermediate weapons, you don't have time. You've got to pretty much make an instant decision. Is this a false alarm? Is this not a false alarm? We need to respond right now.
Right.
And so China's pushing forwards on this, and America and Russia have both pulled out because they were kind of, you know, China was pushing ahead in this area while they were, Russia was just ignoring the treaty. America was held back by it. So now everyone is pushing ahead on this most threatening kind of nuclear missile.
This is definitely a story that we watch closely as we see the development of nuclear technology and all of the different weaponry that's being used that could evade efforts to knock them down that could actually lead to a nuclear war, because there are so many prophecies in the Bible that show that nuclear weapons will be a major component of the next world conflict.
That's right. It really is fascinating how there's so many biblical passages that specifically describe the results of nuclear war, you know, that describe exactly the kind of things that people living thousands of years ago would have no idea about, but you know, you get after a nuclear war. Like, you know, it talks about vines not being able to produce any fruit. It talks about irradiated landscapes. It talks about entire cities being wiped out in some cases. Matthew 24 is probably one of the most direct places where, you know, in Matthew 24, it talks about no flesh being saved alive. That's in verse 22, and that's the Moffat translation puts that, saved alive. You can look into the Greek words used there, and it's clearly not talking about spiritual salvation. It's just talking about there would come a time where, if Christ didn't intervene, man would be able to wipe all life out off the planet. Which, and that would have to be beyond the comprehension of any human mind 2,000 years ago, the idea that all man could wipe himself off this earth. But that's exactly the case that we have with nuclear weapons. So when you've got so many specific warnings in the Bible talking about this, it is something that we do really need to pay attention to. And we have a booklet specifically on that. Nuclear Armageddon is at the doors. Is at the door. And that takes you through those prophecies, talks about what the Bible says about this. But most importantly, it explains why. It explains the brilliant hope behind this problem. Because, yeah, when you're talking about nuclear weapons being used, I mean, that's almost the most hopeless subject that you could get on the surface of things. You're talking about the potential for man to wipe himself out. But this booklet just really shows that this is part of a plan from a loving God. He is in control. He's going to make sure man doesn't destroy himself. And even this nuclear war that the Bible talks about is all part of God's plan that has a beautiful ending. So that book will help you understand what the Bible says about nuclear weapons, what's coming, and then just the fantastic hope beyond that as well.
Thank you very much for that, Richard. We'll link to that in the show notes for the program. Nuclear Armageddon is at the door. You can find it at thetrumpet.com. And just carrying on with this story, a couple more of the nuclear powers that were warned about in that Real Clear Defense article were India and Pakistan. And it turns out that developing this last week is a dangerous situation between these nuclear powers. To learn about this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Monday that India, led by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, made a really controversial proposal about one of the world's most volatile flashpoints. And that proposal was to revoke the autonomous status of Kashmir. and for India instead to assert control over this region. So since 1949, the Indian Constitution has allowed Kashmir to have almost total autonomy. The name of the state is actually Jammu and Kashmir. And this is India's only Muslim-majority state. The rest of India is all Hindu majority. And India has basically let them conduct their own affairs and govern themselves. But this proposal on Monday said the Indian government will now be controlling it. And then the very next day, Narendra Modi turned that from a proposal into reality, with both houses of parliament passing this measure. So the people of Kashmir are deeply upset about this. Right now, the region is on lockdown. There's a total communications blockout, telephone lines, internet, all of that's, it's on lockdown. And even the leader of the state there is on house arrest. But much more importantly, Pakistan is upset by this. Kashmir has been partitioned between Pakistan and India since 1947, the very year that India and Pakistan themselves were split in two. And Kashmir, ever since then, has been a real powder keg for tensions, with both India and Pakistan wanting to control more of it. And then you also have a third party, the Kashmiris, wanting to have, you know, control over themselves. And India and Pakistan have gone to war twice over this region before. And right now, India is becoming much more nationalistic. We spoke on Trumpet Hour back in May about Modi's landslide win in the elections that month and how his Hindu nationalist party, the BJP, won just such a powerful mandate in those elections. And now we see them using that mandate to carry out this power grab on Kashmir, despite whatever the blowback from Pakistan may be.
Yeah, I remember when we were talking about that election victory, you were mentioning that this could embolden him and just make his those pillars of that he's stood on. We talked about specifically India's relationship with Russia, but here you see more of a nationalist tendency that this could really cause him to become stronger. Here's the evidence of that.
That's right. Yes, he's a Hindu, and he's apparently quite pious, and his party, you sort of see religion taking root more and more. When India was first formed in 1947 as a separate entity from Pakistan, Pakistan was a Muslim country, but India was said to be secular. But I think especially in recent years, we see that secularization eroding and India becoming more and more just of this kind of Hindu nationalist entity.
So the relations between India and Pakistan are always tense, but there have been quite significant flare-ups over the years. And the fact that they are two nuclear powers makes the potential for those problems to really create a serious situation. How much does this indicate that this might not just be a flash in the pan? If Modi is willing to take this kind of a step with the mandate that he received from that last election?
Well, it's what you bring up there is a really good point. I think what makes this Kashmir situation so much more important to watch than all of the world's other various border conflicts is the fact that India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons. You know, the world only has 9 nuclear armed powers, and 2 of them are India and Pakistan, and they've gone to war several times against each other, as you mentioned there, and it seems like their hatred for each other in recent years is only deepening, perhaps as religion begins to play a stronger role. The Hindus are more pious in a way, and the Muslims in Pakistan are the same. So really that's why this is something that's really important to watch. Just the worry is that if this tension over Kashmir escalates, first a conventional war could break out, and then that could escalate to a nuclear conflict. And Pakistan has actually made some statements in the last few days that are designed to remind India of its nuclear arsenal and of its willingness to use those nuclear weapons. The president of Pakistan's Muslim League Nawaz political party on Monday said Pakistan will, quote, go to every extent to defend Kashmiris. He said, Kashmir is the jugular vein of Pakistan, and anyone laying a hand on our jugular vein and our honor will meet a frightful end. So he's, you know, somewhat subtly reminding India of the nuclear weapons there and of Pakistan's just willingness to use those over Kashmir.
So looking at just the broad overview, prophetically speaking, relations between Pakistan and India, like, I don't know if it's necessarily 100% clear exactly which direction Pakistan would fall, but we've talked about India being a very important component of the Kings of the East and this Asian alliance, and we see even the way that Modi has conducted himself throughout his presidency, aligning himself more closely with those Asian giants. Pakistan, we've talked about, just because of its Muslim majority, that it could very well end up allying more with the King of the South, or just being pulled more further west.
Right.
Do you see this as kind of demonstrating that sort of a fault line developing?
Well, I think this very well could indicate that sort of thing. Like you, I'm unsure as to where Pakistan will ultimately end up. I think there's evidence that it could be aligned, you know, with Russia and China. Just because of what Ezekiel 38:6 says, it seems to list those peoples there that include who we see mostly in modern Pakistan. But at the same time, it's a theocratic Muslim nation, so it could very well be perhaps in the Psalm 83 alliance, although it's not named there, or with the King of the South. So it's difficult to say, but one way or the other, those nuclear weapons that Pakistan have, I think, make it just a vital country for us to watch as we see these end time events starting to fall into place.
Yeah, I remember when Pakistan first developed those nuclear weapons that Gerald Flurry was talking about, the fact that there is now an Islamic bomb, that you have nuclear weapons in the hands of Muslims right in that region. It's not too far from Iran. So exactly how this unfolds, I guess remains to be seen. We know that nuclear World War III is not going to be triggered by a conflict between Pakistan and India, just because the Bible is fairly clear on how that's going to start. Nevertheless, it seems like every one of these developments on that front with greater tensions, nuclear weapons in the mix, that it encourages other countries to this is exactly the type of thing that's causing other nations to want to arm themselves to the teeth, to improve their nuclear arsenals, to equip themselves to manage the threats that you see happening in the world today. So it's definitely something that is worth keeping our eyes on very closely. And we do have an article on our website that we'll put in the link to in the show notes, Understanding the Kashmir Crisis, that you can find to get more context on this conflict that has developed over this region in India. So thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've spoken a lot in recent weeks about Iranian aggression. This week, Israeli officials voiced concern over a dangerous strategy it believes Iran is developing that puts Israel in jeopardy. To learn about this, we'll turn to Warren Reinch.
Yeah, here we have two small stories just showing how much Iran is focusing on Hamas. And for this first story, it says that Iran is set to boost its funding to Hamas by an unprecedented 200%. An August 5th report by the Times of Israel stated that Iran has expressed a willingness to increase its funding to Hamas from an estimated annual $100 million to $30 million a month. So that's $300 million a year. And that's three times the amount that Iran has already been giving to Hamas to fund its terrorist activities against Israel, which is really an incredible upsurge in funding. The second report says that, according to a July 31st report, Israeli defense officials say that they believe Hamas and Iran have come to an agreement that if war were to break out to Israel's north, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad would open a southern front to divide Israeli troops and air defenses. So this pincer movement is one that comes reportedly directly from Iran. So these two reports are really significant because it shows that Iran is working to forge a mini Iran on Israel's doorstep. Gaza is where Hamas is located. It's basically inside of Israeli territory. It's right there along the border, and it's a prime location for Iran to set up missiles, to set up a missile depot from which they can bombard Israel in the south. The former vice president of Jerusalem Post, his name is Hirsch Goodman, and he wrote this in The Anatomy of Israel's Survival. He said, quote, "In Gaza, Iran's takeover through Hamas and specifically the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which reports directly to Iran's secret service, has been total, creating an entire country, a mini Iran on Israel's southern border," end quote. And that's what Gaza is becoming. It's becoming a miniature Iran right there to Israel's south. I think it's hard for us in America to understand, or even here in Britain, it's very hard to understand what threat Hamas really poses. I think the closest thing that you can come to in America is the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Russian missiles were basically right on America's doorstep. And that's how important this news is.
Now, we've talked quite a bit over the years of how much the, say, when Israel vacated the Gaza Strip and Hamas made that its own territory without Israel's oversight, the way that it had been when it actually had a presence there, that this radicalized Hamas. It gave them a base of operations that made them far more dangerous to Israel. And the ties between Iran and Hamas have been very strong over the years. It seemed like for a little while there, they kind of had weakened in more recent months, and we've seen that relationship resurrected. I wonder if there's just what kind of evidence that the Israelis are presenting that show that this is, how different is this? Because we've talked about, I guess, the threat that they're saying is there from Hamas. We've talked quite a bit over the years about how this is definitely a weapon that Iran would be able to use against Israel. I just wonder how much the situation has really changed recently.
Well, the Hamas deputy chief, Saleh al-Aruri, he's visited Iran 5 times in the past 2 years. And just while he was visiting last month, he said, "We are on the same path as the Islamic Republic, the path of battling the Zionist entity," end quote. So battling Israel, battling or destroying Israel, it's all the same thing. That's the path that they're treading on. Iran, Hamas, it's the same entity. They're basically one and the same. Israeli intelligence even estimates that Hamas has close to 20,000 short and mid-range missiles, all pointed at Israel. And even our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Furry, he's even pointed to this same connection between Iran and the Palestinians. In The King of the South, his booklet, he says that, quote, "The real power behind the Palestinians is Iran. No other nation would dare finance and blatantly encourage such terrorism in Israel. Iran has been caught publicly sending enormous amounts of weapons to the Palestinians. Virtually the whole world knows what Iran is doing, and Israel's terrorist problem keeps getting worse. But with Hamas in control of Gaza, Tehran could ignite another conflict on Israel's western border at any moment." So that's really what we're looking at right here. We're looking at Hamas wanting to destroy Israel. It's even stated in its covenant, the covenant of Hamas. It says that its purpose is to, quote, "raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine." And it's working in the West Bank. It's many Hamas cells have been uncovered by the Shin Bet security service. That's Israeli service. And they found these cells working there, trying to get more of a presence there. The current leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, he's 83 years old. He's struggling health-wise. And when he dies, if he dies very soon, there's possibly going to be a succession war. No one knows who's going to succeed him, and Hamas wants to gain control of that. And that all points to what Bible prophecy says is going to happen, where in Zechariah 14, verse 2, it says that half of the city of Jerusalem is going to fall. And that's exactly what Hamas wants. Hamas wants to gain control of the holy city.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Warren has written a couple of articles, those two stories that he referenced at the beginning of his report there. One of them is Hamas agrees to pincer attack Israel. The other is Iran to drastically increase Hamas funding. That one, I think, will be appearing shortly on the website. The other's already up. But we'll put links to both of those articles in our show notes. Thank you very much for that, Warren. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, news on China boosting its control over one of the world's most important sea gates, economic trouble in Germany, and more, including how there is an important prophetic aspect to the story about white supremacy in America. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
China continues to make strides in strengthening its economic and military dominance of Asia. More movement on this front this week in an agreement with Malaysia. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, in Malaysia, the Belt and Road Initiative is back on. A few years back, Malaysia pretty enthusiastically jumped on board China's Belt and Road project. That's the project that China's using to basically build road and rails and ports and even internet networks and things like that, just to, they say, to resurrect and rebuild the ancient Silk Road network and basically just to better connect the whole world to China. And Malaysia was initially really excited about the whole thing. They invited China into their borders to build major, you know, mega projects and all kinds of infrastructure that would have made Malaysia a key node along this Belt and Road. But then last May, a new prime minister came to power in Malaysia. It was a shock election victory. This was Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, and he did not share in his predecessor's optimism about the Belt and Road. He canceled those mega projects that Malaysia had previously agreed to build with China. He said they were too expensive, China's terms were too steep against Malaysia, so he canceled them. But then, just about 2 months ago, Malaysia announced that they had renegotiated a deal to build the East Coast Rail Link with China. That's a rail line through some very dense and difficult parts of peninsular Malaysia. And the Malaysian leadership found a way to have China pay more and to have Malaysia pay less. So they started the project back up, and they're also looking for ways to restart some of the other projects that had been canceled. So that's been big news. And then just yesterday, Malaysia announced a new system that it's unveiling to attract Chinese investors. The country's trade minister said, quote, "Malaysia's strategic location and competitiveness help embed it deeply within the global supply chain, making it a key part of China's Belt and Road plans." So it's clear that after some initial hiccups and hesitation on Malaysia's part, it's now back on board and it's inviting China right in.
Why is China so interested in cementing this relationship?
Well, the Belt and Road in general, they just want to have as many countries connected to China as possible. But in Malaysia, though, there's even some very specific strategic value. I mentioned the East Coast Rail Link a moment ago. That's a 400-mile rail link that starts on the north coast of peninsular Malaysia. That's kind of where the Gulf of Thailand meets the South China Sea. And it goes all the way down to the southern part of peninsular Malaysia to Port Klang. Port Klang is one of the very important ports controlling passage through the Strait of Malacca. So that's really China's end game here, I think. This project will give China more control over the Strait of Malacca. We talked, I think it was 2 weeks ago, about Cambodia to the north of Malaysia, giving China access to a military base there, and just how that boosts China's control over the Strait of Malacca. And now we see Malaysia doing the same thing for China in an area that's even more crucial to controlling the Strait of Malacca. And it would be difficult to overstate just how important the Strait of Malacca is. One figure that conveys that importance, I think, is that more than 90% of all crude oil flowing through the South China Sea transit. So it's actually the world's second most important shipping choke point by most metrics, second only to the Strait of Hormuz.
So put that in context for us with China's other activities to secure these shipping lanes throughout the region.
Yes, well, we see China building artificial islands, 7 different island outposts, mostly in the Paracel and Spratly island chains, and it's militarizing these just to be able to better control who can sail through the South China Sea, this vital sea that so many of the world's most important shipping lanes go through. And now being able to control the Strait of Malacca and having the shipping base in Cambodia, it's all lining up to just be able to make it difficult for any other power to be able to challenge China's control of this area. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's increase in control over this region, the South China Sea and its periphery, should alarm the world because it means, quote, China is steering the world toward war. That was from an article that he wrote in the Trumpet's July 2016 print edition. The name of the article is China Steering the World Toward War. And I'll just read one short quote from that. It says, China is now challenging 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This should alarm the world. End quote. Mm-hmm. So his article goes on to explain just how this Chinese activity, this tighter grip on this, will soon play a big part in the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern day America and Britain being besieged by China and other nations. That's recorded in Deuteronomy 28:52 and other Bible passages. And Mr. Fleury says that China's increasing control of the South China Sea is one of many areas where right now we can see, quote, we can already see this prophecy moving toward its fulfillment.
Hmm. Well, we'll put a link to that article, China is Steering the World Toward War, in the show notes for today. And thank you, Jeremiah, for that story. The most important nation in Europe is experiencing serious economic trouble. To talk about why this is important to watch, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so Germany's industrial production dropped 1.5% during the second quarter of 2019, according to data published by the German Economics Ministry on Wednesday. And this is an important story. Everywhere you look in Germany right now on their economy, there is bad news. And we'll kind of do a quick survey of as much of it we can fit in a minute. But just think about, as we do that, German politics is already in turmoil after the migrant crisis. You've already got this situation where you've got the Alternative for Deutschland being the most popular party in some of the most economically challenged parts of Germany. So what happens to German politics if we do have an economic downturn and if things do start going badly for Germany? Which we can come back to that point, but some of the statistics. So Andreas Schoeller from Deka Bank, she took some of this industrial data that found that industrial production had fallen and estimated that Germany's economy shrank by 0.2% over the last quarter. Germany's economy is expected to shrink again in the next quarter, which would put Germany officially in recession. So we're looking at Germany officially going into recession now. The German newspaper, well, ING analyst Karl Brzezinski, he commenting on the industrial production report, he wrote, all in all, we would characterize today's industrial production report as devastating with no silver lining. Last month, Deutsche Welle wrote, the most important industrial sector in Germany, the car industry, is in crisis. Likewise, the second most important, mechanical engineering, and also the third most important, chemistry. Everywhere in the German economy, it crashes and rumbles. Are these really just isolated cases or harbingers of a full-blown crisis that we allow to happen? And as I said, everything looks bad. Germany is the third largest exporter in the world. I think by some measures, it's the country most dependent on exports of all the advanced economies. And what do you have right now? Global trade war. That really threatens all of their export markets. You've got President Donald Trump threatening to put more tariffs on what Europe sells to America. Germany's also kind of getting caught in the crossfire a bit with this trade war between America and China, because Germany sells things to China that China uses to make things to sell to America. So as that trade comes to a halt or reduces, there's a knock-on effect to Europe as well. You've got the aftermath of the euro crisis still there, still reducing domestic consumption within Europe. So in southern Europe, people aren't buying German goods the way that they used to. You've got Germany still tightly connected to all of these different financial markets. So you've got any kind of economic or banking crisis in any of these other Eurozone countries is going to hit Germany. You've got Deutsche Bank, the bank that's older than Germany, the bank that literally funded the nation, or that bankrolled the nation. They began eliminating last month 20,000 jobs because they're having economic problems. And this is it's a symbolic issue, but it's also a major part of, they've been loaning to all of these different industries, even regional governments. They really are a cornerstone of the German economy. If they crumble, you've got the potential for the whole economy to start to crumble. You've got all of these fines where Volkswagen, Daimler AG, BMW, Audi, Porsche, they've been facing billion-dollar fines in the United States over these different emission scandals. You've got Germany's top car export destinations are America, France, China, the UK. Although they're all in the top five. So you've got President Trump threatening tariffs on German cars. You've got the United Kingdom threatening a no-deal Brexit that would also include tariffs on German cars. So you've got this industry potentially about to get hit. As I mentioned, you've also got all these mechanical engineering pieces or companies that are having trouble. And then at this same time, you've got the refugees, all these million of refugees that came in 2015, and they're now starting to look for stable jobs and looking for some form of employment. And then you've got an economic downturn with Germans losing their jobs as well. The number of Germans in temporary work or in short-term work has doubled, according to recent stats. So as these migrants start hitting the job markets, that could directly feed into some of these social tensions. So you've got almost this perfect storm of different factors going on that paint a very dark picture of the German economy over the next few months.
You alluded to it a bit when you were talking about just the way that this is affecting politics in the country, and how you have far right parties that the AfD in particular, that has enjoyed a resurgence or really quite amazing popularity, considering how much of a fringe party it's been in the past, in light of these kinds of challenges that are facing the nation. What are the effects that we would expect from a bad economy in Germany, and particularly given Germany's history? Because this definitely has some pretty alarming historical associations.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the 1929 crash and the massive effect that had on the German economy that helped Hitler come to power. He then blamed the Jews for all of this trouble, and it made people desperate for a leader that they perhaps might not have considered when times were better. And then he capitalized on that economic crisis, with large-scale infrastructure projects, spending on the military, this kind of thing, to bring down unemployment. And then people kind of loved him for that. So it played a major role in the rise of Germany. I mean, in the rise of Adolf Hitler. And Mr. Flurry, or Mr. Trump, or Mr. Armstrong warned that you could well see something happen again. He talked about how you could see a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power, larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States. So you could really see how Germany is vulnerable to something like that right now, with their dependence on exports to the United States, that banking crisis in America, that can very quickly lead to economic crisis in Germany. That can lead to political transformation like we've seen already. And then, you know, we're there with a whole new Germany.
Well, we have an article that will be going up on the website here shortly by Josue Michels called Germany on the Verge of Economic Crisis. Gives everything that that Richard was just talking about there, and quite a bit more, putting this in prophetic context, a very important story to keep our eye on. And we appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Some cyber attacks in the Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain have some analysts concerned. They say it could indicate yet another front of aggression being opened up by Iran. For this story, we'll go back to Warren Reinch.
So I have a story here from the Washington or the Wall Street Journal. And it's entitled High-Level Cyber Intrusion Hits Bahrain Amid Tensions with Iran. It says suspected Iranian hackers infiltrated critical infrastructure and government computers in the Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain within the last month, raising fears among leaders in the region that Tehran is stepping up its cyber attacks amid growing tensions. The intrusions rose above the normal level of Iranian cyber activity in the region. Just on Monday, hackers broke into the systems of Bahrain's National Security Agency, which is the country's main investigative authority, as well as the Ministry of Interior and the First Deputy Prime Minister's office. This was back on the 25th of July, Bahrain authorities identified intrusions into its electricity and water authority when hackers shut down several systems in what the authorities believed to be a test run of Iran's capability to disrupt the country. So in this instance, they actually gained control of these systems, these electricity and water systems, which really just shows a huge uptick in Iran's abilities to control other nations. These are all, as was just mentioned, these are test runs of Iran's capabilities. So they're looking to use these against Israel, against America. And you might think that Bahrain is just a tiny country, but it's very significant for a number of reasons, the first of which being that it's the permanent home of the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet and Navy Central Command. This is especially important with think of the tensions in the region, between Iran and America. America has a recent initiative to escort international trade through the Strait of Hormuz, and America has also been just really confronting Iran in this region a lot recently. And then unlike most of the Gulf states where Iran or most of the Gulf states here in the Persian Gulf, Bahrain is unique because it's 70% Shia. Most of the Middle East is Sunni Muslim. So you can see that Iran is trying to gain control of Bahrain as well because it does have a Sunni-led leadership. So because of that, there's been a little bit of conflict between the two nations, but you can definitely see Iran stepping up its game in trying to control the region.
Well, we've been talking about these attacks on ships in Hormuz and drone strikes and different elements of Iran's pushy foreign policy. Here's yet another front that it's opening up and showing increased capability in cyber warfare.
Yeah, Chris Krebs, he's a top security official at the Department of Homeland Security. He said this. Quote, this is an actor that has previously demonstrated a willingness to go destructive. They've done it regionally, and if their calculus changes, they could go globally. Iran is demonstrating through this attack here, they are demonstrating that they are a top technology power. A lot of people see them as almost a low-tech nation, but they actually have a lot more capabilities than people give them credit for. And these attacks could be a part of that push that is mentioned in Daniel 11:40. It talks about the King of the South being Iran and how it's going to have a pushy foreign policy. And this could be an aspect of it. Cyber terrorism is definitely something that is very important. It's something that can have a huge impact on nations. And Iran is already showing that it's willing to go destructive and possibly even global in this area.
Thank you very much, Warren. We definitely have talked quite a bit over the years about just how much cyber warfare could factor in and probably will factor into the coming worldwide conflict. We will put a link to an article by Gerald Fleury in our show notes called America's Achilles Heel and Germany, talking about the prophecy that that demonstrates the likelihood of cyber warfare factoring into that conflict. So we do appreciate that. We started the show talking about how distracted the American media have been trying to pin the blame for mass shootings on President Donald Trump and his white supremacy. But they are missing the real significance of the story. When you look at this story, you can see there is an important angle that is developing here from a Bible prophecy standpoint. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is kind of a nuanced story. President Trump on Wednesday actually went and visited El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, to pay his respect and his sympathies to the people who died there in those two high-pile mass shootings. and then for those who have been following the trumpet for a while will know that the mass shooting in Texas was perpetrated by a murderer who had some concern about illegal immigration and a bunch of other issues. And then the mass shooter in Ohio was a socialist and a Satanist and had expressed a lot of views about immigration detention centers that were being espoused by Antifa, the left-wing terrorist organization. And so preparing to head out for to both these cities to pay his sympathies, President Trump made a comment that said, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's any other kind of supremacy, whether it's Antifa, whether it's any group of hate, I'm very concerned about it, and I will do something about it. So sounds like a fairly reasonable comment to be like, I'm not for Antifa, I'm not for white supremacy, I'm not for any hate group, I'm not for any supremacy. But they've had
let me guess, people didn't like it.
Yes, you have you have guessed right. The I've got a particular, I've got an article from the Atlantic entitled Trump Says There Are Some Very Bad People on Both Sides, which kind of summarizes out some of the reaction you've seen from a lot of mainstream media, talking about how the president's false equivalence amounts to a denial of the role that ideology played in the El Paso shooting. So they're trying to say that, in a nutshell, President Trump is a white supremacist, and he's trying to say that Antifa and white supremacy are equally bad to cover up his role in inspiring this El Paso shooter.
Right.
And if you read this El Paso shooter's manifesto, I mean, he had all sorts of left-wing views on concerning corporations and environmentalism and socialism and health care, in addition to his opposition to illegal immigration. So saying that he's like a typical Trump supporter is a lie. And saying that anyone concerned about open borders is a white supremacist or like this man is a lie. And there's some danger to that, though, because now you've got groups like Antifa, which have been conducting violent terrorist attacks in the United States. And Antifa stands for anti-fascist. One of the problems they've had is that there's like 5,000 people in the Ku Klux Klan. The biggest fascist organization in America has got like maybe 2,000 people. So when you start adding all these people up, there are definitely fascist and white supremacists in America, but it's like, I think I did the math on the back of a napkin one time, and you're like 10 or 20,000 people in all these collective white supremacist groups. And so that's like 0.0005% of the United States population. But if you can, the media can convince them like, oh, well, now all 63 million Trump voters are like that. That's a pretty big recruitment commercial for a group like Antifa. And then if you get more Antifa members, you'll have people that, if you're anti-fascist, I mean, there is that possibility that you could even have an uptick in fascist or white supremacist groups in America. Yeah, so all this divisive language between the the media trying to slur President Trump and his supporters like white supremacist is creating more division in the United States. I think an organization like Antifa, it's hard to track its exact numbers, their membership secret, but I wouldn't be surprised if that group became more popular as a reaction to a fake or minor threat from white supremacy. And it's not even out of the question that if Antifa becomes more popular, that you actually might have a couple of these white supremacist or fascist groups that don't have many members now pick up a few recruits as well as they fight Antifa. And
it seems like as much as you hear in the media the idea that the things that President Trump is saying are divisive, and they're actually saying the things that President Trump is saying are inspiring white supremacists and fascists within the country, how much more if you have this continual flood of accusations from the left that's basically saying not only is Donald Trump a white supremacist, but anyone who supported him is a white supremacist. If you don't completely condemn him and, you know, everything that he says, then you are complicit and you are a white supremacist. How does that type of language not turn a whole lot of people into where they just basically feel like they're standing up for themselves and saying, "No, wait a minute." You could definitely see how just the overall temperature of the public discussion amps up considerably the more that they make these kinds of wild accusations about the president and anyone who supports him. And really looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, I mean, we've talked about a civil war within the United States being a very real threat based on what the Bible says.
Right. Civil war. And there's when you have a civil war, there's always two sides. Now, definitely currently the side that's agitating most the problems is the radical left. And they're telling a lot of lies about the Republican Party and how they're all white supremacist and things like that. But it is creating division that will get violent. I mean, there's prophecies in Ezekiel 1 and verse 7 about your cities are burned with fire. Prophecies in Ezekiel 5 and verse 12 about a third of the population dying in pestilence, which is one of those words you don't hear much anymore. But in the Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet booklet, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has gone back through the Hebrew root word for that word, pestilence, and says it definitely has a connotation of like burning and violence that's even stronger than the connotation it carries with disease. Now disease oftentimes does go hand in hand with civil wars and violence.
Yeah, exacerbating this, you have another report coming out this week about just gun sales in America in the wake of the event last week, the mass shootings last week, and even before that, increasing.
Yes. That's been something that, it seems like almost every year gun sales increase in the United States. It's hard to tell how many guns are actually in the United States because you don't know how many old ones have gone out of service. But the estimates are between 250 million and 300 million. Mm. So and those sales are increasing. Even this week, it looks like they're increasing because with this El Paso shooting and this Dayton shooting, they've gotten a lot of news publicity. And I mean, and people are scared that criminals are coming for them, or drug cartels are coming from them, or mass shooters are coming from them. So I have a report from the Washington Examiner that says gun sales are surging after the weekend mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, fueled by first-time buyers seeking pistols they can carry with them for protection. And the author of this article, Paul Bedard, he interviewed the marketing director for Hyatt's Guns in Charlottesville, North Carolina. And this marketing director said, he said, just this week, we fielded hundreds of calls from people that have never purchased a gun before. Our concealed carry training classes are filling up quickly. People are realizing that even a trip to Walmart isn't safe these days, and they want to be able to protect themselves. And so that's showing just the about a third of Americans own guns, even though.
So at the same time, you have the tensions increasing and being exacerbated, and the division widening in the country. You have guns that are flooding into the population in a way that, when you put it together with the prophecy of the kind of violence and the scale of the violence and the deadliness and the lethality of the violence that's going to besiege the United States before you even have foreign countries coming in to attack, you really see the makings of those prophecies unfolding right before our eyes.
Right, because Ezekiel 5, I mean, you're talking about a third of the population dies in the pestilence before a military invasion even happens. Now in America, that's over 100 million people. It's hard to find a historical precedent for that style of violence. I mean, there was a Stalin made a forced famine in Ukraine where like 25% of the population died. So now you're getting close to 30%. Just logistically, you'd need a lot of firepower to see a prophecy like that fulfilled.
Pretty remarkable. We do have an article on our website called The Coming Civil War. We will put a link to that in the show notes for today's program. And also Mr. Fleury's booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. Thank you for that report, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and you can get those links and all the others that we talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Warren Reinch, and Richard Palmer. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of John Ruskin, "The highest reward for a man's toil is not what he gets for it, but what he becomes by it." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.